It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker from this evening from Plano, Texas, Jennifer H. Kay.
Am I okay? Okay. Hi, y'all. My name is Jennifer Huddleston Kelly, and I am an alcoholic. I've been kept sober since December 5th of 92, and that's my miracle. And the Frisco group in Frisco, Texas is my home group. And it's an honor and a privilege to get to be here, finally. Just saying, I've been there for a minute. At home, it's 10:30. It's almost my bedtime, y'all. But it's okay. I'll stay awake for this. I mean, like, I'm one of my favorite speakers. So, I want to thank the committee for all your hard work. I want to thank poor Natalie. I have been her problem child all weekend long. I mean, just, will you drive me here? Will you pick me up there? But anyway, she has been delightful, and I'm here. So the committee has done a beautiful job. This is a lovely place. My husband, Big Daddy, sends his best. That's me. And I guess I probably ought to just go ahead and start talking, huh? I have not traveled in a minute. I did not travel all summer long, and so I feel real rusty. When I got my suitcase out, my little dog started acting weird, as he does. And I started getting anxious because I never know how it's going to go. I always know I'm going to have a great time here. But getting from A to B is a little tricky these days, especially when flying while fluffy. I've struggled a little bit because of some health problems and things like that. I'm not used to not always feeling great. And so it takes a little more prayer and a little more meditation and a little more being centered and present. So I was talking to the dog, and I was just saying, I know, buddy, this is really hard, and I miss you and Daddy when I'm gone. And my husband said, you mean like when I leave for work every single day? Isn't that the sweetest dang thing you've ever heard in your life? Let me tell you how self-centered I am. It never crossed my mind that he felt that way. Never occurred to me that he missed us while he was gone, because I only think about me. So while I'd like to take a lot of credit for the progress I've made in 33 years, I got a ways to go. So I'm going to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I'm not very good at in a general way. I'm an oversharer, and I don't practice this stuff. So whatever comes out, and I will only know I've gone too far when I see your eyes get real big. Like, I don't think I would have shared that part. And I always start in the same place because it's the only place I know where to start. I was born at a very early age on November 16th in 1966. I was born to a football coach and an English teacher. My birth date is 111666 for you Revelations fans. And very inconveniently, I was born into a non-alcoholic family. If you're going to be an alcoholic, I recommend being born into an alcoholic family so you can blend. If you get born into a non-alcoholic family, they notice. And they notice right away. I mean, they're not slow to pick up on stuff. I was always the weird kid. And even before I ever took a drink, I remember my daddy sitting me down and going, Jen, honey, I just think there's folks who feel too much. Yes, sir. I mean, like, what are we going to do with this? And he never had an answer for that. I've been walking around with big feelings since the day I came out the chute, and I have not known what to do with that. I have always been jealous of people who can do one feeling at a time. Like, cause I do feeling casseroles. Like, I mean, it's just all this stuff all at once. And I didn't know. Nobody knew how to tell me. It's cause you're self-centered. It's cause you're thinking about you all the freaking time. And so I learned how to be funny, so it looked like I meant to be like this, you know, but truly this just sort of my brain eating my face off is like my normal state. You can just follow me around the Kroger on any given Tuesday and I may be talking out loud to the voices in my head. And that's That's with 33 years sober. I mean, it's been worse. But what I know about me is I was happy and healthy and wanted and loved for almost 3 whole years. And we have some pictures. And then they brought home a bouncing baby resentment. And she ruined everything. She ruined any opportunity I might have to blame my alcoholism on my parents, because we went to the same schools. Went to the same church. We were potty trained in the same way. And we turned out just a little different. She went to high school and graduated. She went to college and graduated in 4 years. In 4 years. I'm 59 and I'm a sophomore. And I've been a sophomore for a while. I might die a sophomore. Only thing in my life I've ever paced myself at. When my little sister graduated from college, she chose a career. She went to go work for Jesus in Bulgaria. She was a missionary. Isn't that precious? I was a cocktail waitress in a pool hall. So we were both doing God's work in our own way with the poor and the downtrodden. I was just bringing them home with me. And she was giving them Jesus comic books. So while she was in Bulgaria, she met a Bulgarian man. They dated, they got married, and they had sex in that order. And they lived happily ever after. Now, Big Daddy and I married 17 years ago, and one of us was not a virgin. One of these things just doesn't belong here, and I'll tell you what. For years, as I heard AA stories, I thought when you talked about what you were like, where you came from, all these stories, that you were explaining why you were alcoholic. And just for the new people, let me assure you, this stuff is not why we're alcoholic. The reason that I'm alcoholic is covered in masterly detail in the doctor's opinion. And I truly believe that it is very important to sit down with somebody who understands the book and read the doctor's opinion so you can find out if you're alcoholic or not. I sat in AA for over a year, relating to a lot of what you said, but not being clear on what it meant to be an alcoholic. But when somebody went line by line through the doctor's opinion with me and asked me questions, I solved the mystery. Turns out I'm one of you and I don't have a light case. But sometimes the language gets confusing, and it still happens. People with long-term sobriety start talking about having the craving like they're thinking about Chinese food. And that's not what we're talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous. The phenomenon of craving happens after we drink, not before. The Chinese food happens before we eat the Chinese food, but not after. And so I needed somebody to help me understand that when I drink, something flips a switch and I always need more. And I didn't know that. I didn't understand what an alcoholic was, even sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. But first, I probably ought to drink. So my parents were school teachers, and we went to work and we went to church, and they did the right thing even when nobody was looking. And I was restless, irritable, and discontent from the get-go. I'm from Plano, Texas, the land of drill team. Football is a religion where I'm from, and I'm built like this. I mean, you know, I didn't look like this in high school, but I felt like this in high school, you know? All my little friends were cheerleaders and drill teamy girls. Yay! Inside of me beats the heart of a Barbie, but my body's made by Tonka. And I'm so envious of those little girls, and I wanted a boyfriend real bad, but I scared the fish, and I finally got one on the line, and turns out he's gay, which was very disheartening. And I got mad at him and I got mad at God and I got drunk at them both. You know, I started out this nice little church girl, but if being good didn't get me what I wanted, what's the point? And my friends had started drinking in middle school, but I didn't because I was on the God squad. And but once I these, you know, repeated disappointments kept happening, all of a sudden I'm just like, what am I being good for? And I had decided that the gay boyfriend would be my introduction to sin, but he kind of fell down on the job. And and so then I decided to drink. And it was the night before a church trip, and we were all at Yolanda's house. And Yolanda was fighting with her boyfriend back when phones were on walls. And she was being absolutely no fun. And my friend Susie was there, and Susie was the drill teamy girl. And she looks exactly like you think a Susie from Texas, who's a drill teamy girl, would look. She had gigantic blonde hair and a teeny tiny waist and huge pom-poms. And she could do the splits for no reason. Yay! And I don't know if you can tell, but I've had to do a little writing about girls like Susie. Because girls like Susie say, I'm cold, and suddenly half the room is leaping over furniture to change the thermostat and grab a blanket. Jennifer, chop some wood. Susie's cold. And I'm that chick out in the parking lot changing her own tire, just bitter, just bitter. And it wasn't until I was doing my inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out why I was the girl out in the parking lot changing her own tire. Because I was so certain that you wouldn't help that I never told you. I was so sure that you wouldn't hold the door open for me, I never waited. And I was so sure you'd never ask me out that I literally didn't hear you when you did. My beliefs were creating my reality, but I didn't know that. Now, I'm not saying girls like Susie don't get a little extra attention. Because I'd be foolish if I thought that. But I am saying that the story I wrote about who she was and what she got was a fantasy, and it didn't matter because I acted like it was truth. And Susie is one of the sweetest girls I've ever known. She is still my friend to this day. But I kind of hate her guts a little bit. You know, I mean, just kind of that deal. And it happened that I had gotten very curious about drinking and shut me up. This was in the land before Google. I was asking a lot of questions about drinking and to shut me up, somebody gave me two bottles of leftover wine, a bottle of Boone's Farm Tickle Pink and a bottle of Real Sangria. And I put it in the back of my dad's Cutlass Supreme, and I drove around with it in the Texas heat for several months. That wine that has never seen a grape isn't tasty to start with, but let me tell you something. If you roll it around in the heat for a while, by the time we drank it, it had taken on what I can only describe as a meaty quality. It was somewhere between liquid and gummy bear. So I remembered these two bottles of wine, and I asked Susie if she wanted to get drunk, and she did. And so we started out closet drinkers. We sat on the floor of a closet and we drank this wine. And Susie had drank before, but I hadn't. And I'll tell you something. As I said, Susie is still my friend to this day. And if you ask Susie what happened that night, she will say that, it was blood and urine and vomit. Just a lot of DNA. I mean, that's the part she'll talk about. She'll talk about broken glass, and she'll talk about broken promises, and she'll talk about the hangover. And I'm not saying those things didn't happen, but why would you focus in on that part? Because what happened to me was it changed my perception. When we started drinking, Susie didn't even know that in my mind she was up here and I was down there. And she didn't know that when we finished that first bottle of wine, we were neck and neck. And she didn't know that when I drank that second bottle of wine, I could take her at anything, including doing the splits. Drinking made me feel like I could do anything I wanted to do. It created this mirage that things were great and getting better. And my book tells me that right here in my drinking, I could probably quit, but why? So much fun. So much fun. That night we laughed and we talked and we wet our pants and we puked, and it was the best night of my life. We played this magical game I came up with because the bed was spinning and the ceiling fan was going the other direction. And I convinced Susie that we could stop the fan with our mind. It was a very short game because then the puking began. And that next morning, I didn't know anything about drinking and I certainly knew nothing about wine. And I had never been thirstier in my life. Y'all remember that? You'd wake up and your tongue had grown hair. And I leaned over the bathroom and drank a couple of gallons of water. And then I headed downstairs. We were at a Hispanic girl's house and her mother had made huevos rancheros for breakfast. So I puked again. And then I got on a bus to sing for Jesus. And I was both of those things. And I loved both of those things. But the problem was that by Tuesday, the kumbaya wore off. And on Tuesday, even though I hadn't drank, all I had to do was think about drinking. And a sense of ease and comfort would wash over me. You see, alcohol is so powerful in my life. After my first or second time drinking, I get a sense of ease and comfort just thinking about drinking. And so I'm off to the races. I graduated from high school and I went towards college. You've already heard how stunningly successful I was at that. I took a test that said I would be really good at college. That test lied. It assumed several things not in evidence. It assumed that I would show up, and I didn't show up. I was so scared. I had been the president of everything you would let me be president of in high school. And I graduated in a class of 1,500. It's not like I was from a small place or that I was look at me. I've never met a microphone I didn't like. You know, I'm not a shy person, but I am a self-absorbed person. And I got to my college and I was anonymous and I didn't know what to do with that. And so I walked around with my brain eating my face off and I'm not old enough to drink. And I made a lot of decisions by not making decisions. And I moved in with a girl that was older than me and really liked me in a way I could not like her back, which made it real awkward. And I didn't know how to talk about any of this stuff. And I'm just wandering around feeling 45 feelings at once with no idea what to do with that. And thank God I turned 19 in November and the drinking age was 19 back then. And could not wait to drink. My first night of legal drinking, me and my friend Slaps drove through the beer barn backwards because we don't follow directions. But we got our first little drinks and we sat in a parking lot to drink, to warm up, to go to the bar. If you have to drink in preparation for drinking, you might be an alcoholic. And that night we went to a bar and we fell into Weird. Man, I met him. Because drinking and men go together like peanut butter and chocolate for me. I'm just saying. And that night I met him and man, was he something. He had no job and no car. He had long hair and a long beard and he didn't like shoes and his friends called him humongous, which I found fascinating. I still don't know why, but anyway, I wish y'all would stop laughing at that joke so I could stop telling it. It's just so tacky. It's true, but it's tacky. And for some girls, you know, the fact that a guy has no job and no car would go on the cons side of the list. But men tend to wander off on me. So I found that if you date a man with no job and no car, and I do mean Alka dating, you can drop him off somewhere. And when you come back later, he's still there. Or he's really easy to track because he's on foot and looks like Sasquatch. And so that night, we put his bicycle in the back of my car and we headed off to the commune. And I wish I was making that up, but I'm not. In 24 hours, I became a hippie chick, which basically just means I gave up hygiene. And I started living at his place. Now I respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I will talk very little about my drug use, but I am going to talk about his. He and his friends like to trip on acid, and I got to say something. I was impressed with their ingenuity and planning. You see, they made all the plans before they did the drugs, and then they did the drugs. It was so impressive. They would organize things, build the bonfire, synchronize the sundial, whatever it was, and then they do the drugs. Alcoholics get drunk, and then we go, you know what, we need a plan. And we start devising a plan with no equipment with which to make one. And so these guys would do the thing that they do. And I was the chaperone for their acid trips. And I had two responsibilities. I had to make sure that they didn't run into the fire or touch sharp things. And what I didn't know then that I now know, because I went through the steps with a sponsor, is that the reason that these guys were so attractive to me was that they weren't the kind of people who were going to say, Jennifer, we're concerned about your drinking. They were off naked in a field playing tambourines, waiting for the mothership to come. They were not counting how many beers I was having. And without even realizing it, I had begun to rearrange my life to accommodate my drinking. And I didn't even know. I didn't even know. I flunked out of school in record time, which was really pretty impressive, and I made my big geographic. I moved one town away, bridge and a lake, and it's a whole new world. And I show up in my new town as a hippie chick, and have to buy a razor anyway. And I'm driving down Main Street. I have not even unpacked a box, and I see this life-size orange horse, and I decide in this town I'm gonna be Patsy Cline. And I go to this hairdresser shop, and I say, tweezing me up some cowgirl hair. And I start talking like Reba McEntire immediately. And I sit down in this chair, and this hairdresser says, you party, don't you? And I think it's my aura. I don't know that beer comes out your pores. I'm not terribly self-aware, So she offers me a cold beer and is going to do my hair. And we get drunk. And this is going to turn out exactly as bad as you think it will. This was the 80s, and I got a perm. Let me just tell you something. Everybody got a perm in the 80s. Men, women, dogs, and chickens, they all got perm. There are bald men in this room that had a perm in the 80s. So I'm getting my perm, and we are feeling no pain. And that's when she took the rollers out, and I discovered I had a shrubbery on top of my head. And that's when she grabbed the scissors, and it was not a good idea. By the time she was done, I had asymmetric hair. I had long hair on this side and short hair on this side. She twirled me around, and I looked in the mirror. She's kind of bobbing and weaving behind me, and she says, nobody in town has this haircut. I'm thinking nobody in town wants this haircut. But then she says the magic words, you want to go honky-tonking? And I did. I had never honked nor had I tonked, and yet I was in. So I went to the place with the life-size orange horse. I got me some hot pink ropers and a belt buckle the size of my head. And that night, Papaw was twirling me, and things were great and getting better. Because that's what alcohol does for a girl like me. It takes me to a seedy bar and makes me think I'm an urban cowboy. It's just magic. And then I come to, this nice little girl who prayed before she lost her virginity, who thought she'd be a minister when she grew up, who graduated with honors, came to looking for a cowboy belt to see the name of the man she's waking up beside you. It was a dark day when they stopped putting names on the back of belts. That was very handy. Morning, Frank. You know, I mean, again, I wish I was making that up. Kind of forgot to mention that I chose a career with a hangover. I became a preschool teacher. Again, they're gonna notice. So I'm rolling in there late and hungover and smelling like God knows what. And these sweet little women are just worried to death about me. Jennifer, how can we help you? And I'll tell you what, you ask me if you can help, and I got some ideas. How about we start the day a little later? And the nice thing about those ladies is they said yes. And they said yes. And they said yes. And I'd been just saying no to drugs for quite some time, and then one day I just said yes. And I didn't say yes because I'm an addict or an addict in training. I said yes because somebody said it would help me control and enjoy my drinking. And I think, why didn't anybody mention that sooner? And it was like, get out of my way. I mean, like, I had been saying no to this stuff for a long time. And all of a sudden, it's a big fat yes. And now I'm a really quick preschool teacher. For a brief and shining moment, I didn't need no Ozempic. I can assure you that. My teeth were falling out my head, but you know, life is full of trade-offs. And gradually things got worse. And I didn't do that stuff for very long because I scare other people when I drink. I frighten me when I do drugs. And a DEA agent showed up at my apartment. I wasn't a go-getter or nothing. I'm just thrifty. And so I was running around with some manufacturers and distributors as a cost-saving measure. And these guys said, hey, if you keep doing what you're doing with who you're doing it with, when they go to prison, you'll go too. And y'all, I was clean in 24 hours. I didn't need a sponsor, a stiff metal chair, a three-line prayer, nothing. I didn't even have to announce I quit doing it because I put on 100 pounds in about 72 hours. It was impressive. I would go to Taco Bell in a blackout. It really was impressive. Even in a blackout, I am concerned about what you think about me. And so I would order all this food and four drinks like I'm taking it home to daddy and the babies. And gradually things got worse. And this nice little church girl who prayed before she lost her virginity has jobs and no jobs, men and no men, utilities and no utilities. I'm alternating jobs between teach and preschool. And then when they would get so rigid about me being there every day, fully clothed, prepared to function, I would quit and I would go work in the bar. Because drunks and four-year-olds are very similar. And but then there were no bumpers, and man, I need some guardrails, and I'd start scaring myself, and I'd go back to the daycare and sing some songs about animals and eat some fish sticks, and then they'd start having the talk with me. And meanwhile, I'm picking up a few DWIs. It's just a hobby of mine. I get somewhere and I get restless, irritable, and discontent. People aren't paying attention to me the way they should. Maybe they'll be nicer to me over at that other bar. And I start getting pulled over, and I never cry my way out of it. I've heard a lot of women in AA say, I cried and he let me go. I cried and I went to jail every freaking time. And today that's the good news, because it may have saved my life or somebody else's. And gradually things got worse. By that second DWI, man, it was rough. Because I had this attorney who worked out of his garage, and because that's the dude I can afford. And he said, Jennifer, when they pull you over again, here's what I want you to do. And I thought, that's weird. I got my patch. You know, you got your alcoholic patches. If you go to bed with somebody and you wake up in the morning and you discover he has fewer limbs than you remember him having the night before, you get your prosthesis patch. And, you know, you get your transportation patch. And if you ever slept with family members, not realizing they were family, like an uncle, and it's, anyway, you get your family tree patch. Anyway, really, alcoholism's kind of like the Girl Scouts. And so I got my DWI patch, and this lawyer said, when they pull you over again, here's what I want you to do. And I thought, that's weird. I already got my patch. I don't need two of these. And what I realized was that I hadn't told him about my plan. I had this really solid plan. Most of the alcoholics in the room will recognize this plan. Most of the Al-Anonics in the room will notice the flaw with the plan. The plan is be more careful. I mean, what could go wrong here? Turns out I drink the no care juice. And when I drink the no care juice, it's almost impossible to be more careful. And so I get that second DWI, and that's when I discover I have a problem. I got a driving problem, and I set up to solve the driving problem. I move next door to my favorite bar. I'm a big picture kind of gal. I got that alkalogic going. Problem solved. But wherever I go, there I am. And I have a disease that is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and I don't even know that I have it. And gradually things got worse. There were men and no men and jobs and no jobs and utilities and no utilities. My house became a very violent and ugly, disrespectful place. There were nights when there were these huge, nasty fights. I used to say our love was so big we had to take it outside. And what would really happen is that he'd be passed out and I'd be analyzing our relationship, me and the evil sock puppets. Some people call that the committee. I call them the evil sock puppets because I don't want it to sound like they are acting in an official capacity. But eventually I'd wake him up and eventually I'd slam him against the wall and eventually I'd be screaming in his face. And then I'd take all his clothes and I'd throw them off the balcony. We lived on the third floor because that's where alcoholics like to live. We need that $20 off our rent. And I'd throw all those clothes off the balcony and I'd say, get out. And he'd go, okay. And that wasn't the line. And so now I got to follow him. And so I'm yelling stuff at him and he's you're not taking my car. I really like men with no cars. It's kind of my thing. Wasn't planning on it. And eventually I'd get terrified because he had nothing left to say. He wasn't fighting with me. And man, you know, they'll still fight. They still care. But when they've got nothing left to say to you, man, I got this terror because I think he's the only thing tying me to the planet. And I thought whatever this was love. And so I'd say, get back up there. And he'd go, okay. I mean, all he wanted to do was pass out. I'm the one doing the whole thing. He's tall and skinny. I'm short and fat. We look like spaghetti and meatball going down the road. And I pick up all his clothes and hang them back in the closet. We're doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. But it seems like a new game every time we play it. Because I got a head like an Etch-a-Sketch. You shake it twice and there's nothing there. You shake it twice and I've forgotten the suffering and the humiliation of a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink and I have no idea it's the first drink. Our neighbors caught on to doing the same thing, expecting different results, but we didn't. It was a new game every time we played it. And then he decided to go in the Navy to get away from me. And this is a pattern we discovered in my inventory. Apparently, if you live with me for more than about a year and a half, you wind up in the armed services. Seriously, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Salvation Army. I mean, it's impressive. Like an unpaid recruiting officer. And it's not because I'm dating particularly patriotic fellas. It's just that if you're going to get screamed at every day of your life, you might as well get paid for it. So he joined the Navy and I forgot what a jerk he was and he forgot what a jerk I was and we tried to get married and he drank a little bit like I drank and so he kept getting thrown in the brig and I kept forgetting to be faithful. Look, I'm not promiscuous. I just sleep with a lot of people. And I tell you what, if it had been lust, I'd probably brag about it. But what I know about my inventory is that it was a little more transactional than that. You see, I didn't keep alcohol in my home. And so when the bar shut down, I'd have to find somebody to go home with. And the reason I didn't keep alcohol in my home, and again, I didn't know this in real time. It was only going back through the book with a sponsor. When I was 19 years old and still in college, one of my friends from high school got drunk at a party. He passed out on his back and he asphyxiated on his own vomit and died. I went to his funeral. And I saw how broken his mother was. And I saw how sad his friends were. And I saw how tragic this loss was. And I was so far from ever believing I had a problem with drinking. But I knew I drank like that. And I just made a decision, I suppose, that I could never drink at home or alone because I drank like that. And what that meant was that I would turn my will and my life over to the care of anybody who would have it when the bar shut down. And when you do stuff like that, some things begin to happen. And it'll put a little dirty on you that soap doesn't wash off. And it was a big deal the first time it happened. And it was a pretty big deal the second time it happened. And by the third time it happened, it just became something where I changed the story. I just changed the story I told myself so that I wouldn't have to face the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And gradually things got worse. When I read the book Alcoholics Anonymous for the very first time, I had not come to see you yet. I was reading it alone. And it talked about alcoholics drinking for oblivion. And I looked up the word oblivion, and what my dictionary said was to seek to forget or to be forgotten. And in that, alcoholism in a nutshell, it's not the party. It's not the dreams. It's not the big stories and the games we play. It's forgetting or being forgotten. That's what alcoholism is to me. You're going to be shocked to figure out we couldn't get married. He kept getting thrown in the brig, and I kept forgetting to be faithful, and alcoholism was kind of destroying our plans, and so I moved back home. The daycare, the walls were kind of closing in. I was about to get fired, and so I quit, and I moved back in with my parents, and I just brought alcoholism to live with them. I wasn't thinking about quitting. I had really good reasons to drink. But I was terrifying those poor parents of mine that don't drink. I was scaring them to death. You see, the people who love us most, especially those who don't live the way we live, they think we're safer under their roof than we are out on the streets. And what we're really doing is just making them as sick as we are. Nobody ever talked to me about what I was doing because they were so afraid. I held them hostage by their fear. And for I don't know how many months, they locked doors and hid money and tried to navigate around me as they were watching their smart and funny and talented girl be angry and sullen and erratic and dishonest. And gradually things got worse. On November 19th of 1992, I got a felony DWI. I was coming home from the bar. I was 3 days late for my own party. I had asked them to throw the party. I knew the party was going on, but I started drinking in one town, and I don't pause once I start. And so I didn't show up, but people had been at that party, and they had left money for me, and they had left presents for me, and they had bought me drinks. And so I showed up 3 days later to get those things. And I was driving back home, and I had this home bar in the town I used to live in, and I was living in a different town, so I'd drive through three counties drunk every night. And I saw the cop behind me, and he saw me, and he pulled me over. And it wasn't different than any other time. I mean, he came up to the window, and he asked the question we all know he's going to ask. How much have you had to drink? Everybody in here knows the correct answer to that question. I know the correct answer to that question. And out of my mouth comes $67 worth. And I'm looking around to see where that came from. Because this was 1992, y'all. We weren't having $12 cocktails. Like, this is a tell. And he just chuckled. Like, I was his easiest customer that night. I said, I'll tell you what, I know I'm drunk and you know I'm drunk. How about we just do the pen thing and you just take me to jail? And he thought that was a great idea. And so I went to jail and I had a moment of clarity sitting in a jail cell, and it was just that I could no longer say, what's a nice girl like me doing in a place like this? For that moment in time, I saw myself exactly as I was. I knew I was there because I drink, not because I drive. And I know that I drink because it's the only way I know how to do life. And if they let me out, I'll drink again. I can't swear to me, God, or anybody else I won't do it again because I know I will. And I said a prayer and I asked God for help and I made a decision to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I meant all of those things because I was desperate. And then they let me out. And I made one teeny tiny mistake. I started trying to clean up the mess before I went to AA. By then I was the assistant director of the daycare and they noticed I was supposed to unlock the daycare on the day I was thrown in jail. And there was a whole parking lot of parents and kids. And whoopsie, Miss Jennifer was not there. And I was in a lot of trouble. And I'm trying to get out of trouble. And I'm trying to get the car out of impound. And every lawyer in Dallas is sending a mail to my parents' house, which is really inconvenient. And I got to pay the garage attorney and nobody can find out about this and it's all bad and it's all big and I'm a little suicidal-ish and I can't will my way in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm driving around, any orbiters? Me and I drive around in AA group over and over and over. I sit in nearby parking lots practicing saying my name is Jennifer and I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I'm just losing it because I want to be anything but an alcoholic. I'm the kind of drunk who comforts herself with the idea that this could be a brain tumor. Wouldn't that be awesome? And what happened to me was I got there at meeting time and I almost had to walk in. Like the door was open and everything, but I got that alcoholic and my brain just said, you don't have an AA book. You can't go to AA without an AA book. So y'all, I left the place where the AA books live to go on this 3-day quest to find an AA book. I went to Barnes & Noble. They had them there. They were like $10. I was not that optimistic about Alcoholics Anonymous. So then I went to the half-price books. They got them there. The problem with the ones at the half-price books, willy-nilly highlighting. All jacked up, man. No color-coded. How are you going to know? What's the prayers? What's the promises? I mean, just jacked up. Willy-nilly highlighting. The first 27 pages is horrible. The rest of the book is clean as a whistle. But man, that first 27 pages looks terrible. And I wish I was making this up, but I'm so arrogant. I think I can't have some loser influencing my opinions about Alcoholics Anonymous. So eventually I find a book worthy of my study. And now I can't go to the meeting because I got to read it by myself. That's going really well. You know, I'm detoxing and I'm reading about being boiled as an owl. I mean, it's really, keep saying there's good news in there. I can't find it. I cannot find it. And it's while I'm reading the book by myself, trying to will myself into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous without anybody's help but mine, that I get drunk one last time. And I had no intention of getting drunk. I just went to a bar to talk to a criminal about my legal problems. Y'all know. I mean, I just knew a guy who had 8 DWIs and he was still drinking in the home bar. And my garage attorney said I was going to do a year in jail, best case scenario. And I'm thinking, here is a man with a real answer. Why would I bother these nice people in AA when Jimmy's got 8 DWIs and he's still drinking in the home bar? So I go to talk to Jimmy the criminal about my legal problem. I'm not going to drink. I'm not an idiot. Until I talked to Jimmy and he says, oh, Jen, honey, I can afford to be the kind of drunk I am. You can't afford to be the kind of drunk you are. When the worst drunk you know starts talking down to you a little bit, you're having a real bad day because I can't pass college algebra, but 8 DWIs is more than 3 DWIs. And yet he's saying something like, you know, this could be an opportunity to find a new way to live. And I know exactly what that fool is talking about. He's telling me I should go to the ANA. And I could kick him right in the baby maker. How dare he talk to me that way? And yet I'm thinking, who would know better than Jimmy? Jimmy knows how I drink and he knows how I think and he knows how I feel. Jimmy knows. And the other thing that happened was at some point there was a drink in front of me and I drank it. And I didn't decide to drink it. I just drank it because it was in front of me. And when a drunk like me has nothing in between them and the next drink, she drinks it. That's how people with 20 years drink again. because at a certain time, there's nothing in between them and that next drink. The difference between then and now, I pray to God, is that I have a lot of things in between me and the next drink. You gave me those things. You gave me a relationship with God. You gave me prayers. You gave me a meditative practice. You gave me love and service. You gave me a sponsor that I am accountable to. You gave me sponsees who call me and count on me to answer the phone. You gave me many, many gifts. But that day there was nothing in between me and the drink at the end of my arm. And I drank it. And it terrified me. Because I couldn't believe I had done it, knowing how much trouble I was in. I did it again. And it was just like that book had said. And so I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous on December 4th in 1992. And I went into the Plano group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was this little greenhouse where furniture goes to die. I had been trying to get there since 7 in the morning, and I made it to a 10 p.m. meeting. And they turned out the lights and they lit the candles, and I knew I was in a cult, but I had nowhere else to go. I sat where the newcomer loves to sit. It's in the back, as close to the door as humanly possible. Because while I made a deal with God in the parking lot that I would stay for the whole meeting, I didn't know if I could keep that promise. And I didn't want to be stumbling over you trying to get out of there. But right before the meeting began, they were sitting in a circle at one end of the room and I was at the other. And it was a tiny room, but it felt real big. And somebody said, hey, why don't you come sit here? There's a chair right here open for you. And I believe my recovery began when I gave up my idea and started trying yours. I didn't even know why I did it, but you made a suggestion and I took the action. And my life has been changed ever since. Now I have had to do a lot of things to keep my chair in Alcoholics Anonymous. Things I didn't want to do, things I didn't think I could do, things I wasn't particularly happy about doing. But nothing was as big as that night, walking through the door and doing what somebody else suggested without needing for it to make any sense. I just joined the circle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And things happen when you're in the circle of AA. I'm just going to warn you. Once you get in, get all the way in. Because let me tell you, if you're in the circle of AA, you can walk through anything that you got to walk through. One of the greatest gifts of sobriety that I have is that all the things that I was afraid of before I got here, almost all of them have happened. I lost both my parents. And I walked through it sober because you showed me how. I fell in love and married a nice man. Then I got pregnant and I miscarried. And I stayed sober because you showed me how. I bottomed out financially so many times it's embarrassing. But I stayed sober because you showed me how. The circle of Alcoholics Anonymous is so powerful, but we gotta be in it. We gotta hold the hand of somebody who's got more time than us, and we gotta hold the hand of somebody who's got less. That is the safest place for an alcoholic to be. And I didn't know that night. I was just fresh out of bright ideas. And I sat in that meeting and I listened to y'all share, and bless your hearts. Sometimes you get so excited that there's somebody new in the room. You forget, we don't know what the hell you're even talking about. Because please notice, I didn't say I went straight to treatment. I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. And I didn't come from an alcoholic home. And I didn't really know what alcoholism was. I knew that I drank too much too often, but I was equally convinced that if somebody would just love me enough, I'd stop doing this stuff. And so I didn't really even know if I was in the right room. And bless your hearts, y'all are so excited. You're telling me about the big book picnic and the three legacies and the sponsor. And you sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. And I don't know what you're saying. And I'm certainly not humble enough to raise my hand. But thank God, about halfway through the meeting, a man named Gene began to share. Nobody cares what he was wearing but me, so I'm going to tell you. He was wearing bib overalls. Oh, my God, I love overalls. I believe when we get to heaven, we're going to get these Czechoslovakian pastries that I really like. And we're going to get our wings and we're going to get our overalls. Because seriously, y'all, it's nature's perfect garment. It's got all these pockets. It's not binding. Is she wearing a bra? We don't know. She's got on overalls. I mean, it's just magical. And so anyway, so God sent me a messenger wearing overalls, and he had on a camo fishing cap, and he had a ZZ Top beard, and he was not a member of the Mensa, you know? But he knew how to talk to a baby drunk in a way that a baby drunk can hear. And what he said was, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. Hell, I just thought I was thirsty. Finally, somebody in here is making some sense. It would have been profound if he stopped there. But he said, my problem is the more I drink, the thirstier I get. And it begins with the very first drink. And from that day to this, that is the most eloquent way I've ever heard the phenomenon of craving described. The more I drink, the thirstier I get. It begins with the very first drink. So the whole ballgame for a drunk like me is how not to take the first drink. And that's what you've been teaching me for 33 years. Nothing is ever quenched when an alcoholic drinks. I will always want more. I will drink till I run into something or till I run out of something, but I am constitutionally incapable of going, well, that's plenty, I'm good. That's not how I'm designed. And at a cellular level, that's how I operate. It says that I require a psychic change, and one of the definitions for psychic is of the spirit. I need a soul change. And y'all, I don't even know. I put my soul to sleep a long time ago. How am I going to fix that? Well, what you told me was that I was going to need a higher power, and I could choose my own conception, which sounded like the goofiest thing ever. I mean, I wouldn't trust you people with the sharp scissors, and all of a sudden you're telling me I can choose my own God. That doesn't make no kind of sense. Unless you're desperate and don't want to die. And during that time, I had to go to counseling. It wasn't my idea. I mean, it had been my idea, but then the state of Texas told me I had to. And so it became a stupid idea. And I went to counseling with a retired minister from my childhood faith who just happened to be in love with the 12 steps as a spiritual path. He was not one of us. He just thought that the 12 steps were the perfect spiritual path. I mean, you know why I hired him? Cheap. He was cheap. And I go see this guy who just happens to be in love with the 12 steps. Little old man, ancient. He was 400 years old. He was on oxygen. I'm not kidding. So this little trampy girl, you know, 26 years old, talking out loud to the voices in her head, is talking to the retired minister on his oxygen. I mean, it was a match made in heaven. And he gave me permission to take that second step. I tried to tell on y'all. And I said, listen to what these goofballs are saying. Suddenly I'm a theologian. They're saying you could choose your own conception. How weird is that? I mean, we already know. There's one. And he said, my book says that he is the Alpha and the Omega. That pretty much covers everything. Why don't you just start somewhere? I think God can take it. If you'll just start somewhere, God will reveal himself to you. Which is kind of what our book said. He's in cahoots with the book people. And so I took the second and third steps. Because what else are you going to do? I took the third step and then I spent a weekend in jail for my felony DWI. I wish I had time for that story. Because I almost got locked up while in jail. Being a helper. I just randomly decided to go off and fill out some paperwork that nobody told me to fill out because I'm a little go-getter and they frown on that. I spent that whole weekend just terrified chanting the third step prayer. My sponsor thought I should probably start my fourth step in there, and I assured her I was not going to do that. But what did happen was that the third step sunk in as I was laying on a bunk bed in a jail. And I thought, I don't ever have to come back here if I keep doing what I'm doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I did come back. I went back to jail sober one time just to make sure it still sucked. Because I threw away a parking ticket. That's how I learned about the 10th step. Turns out 10th step, more important than 10 years. Who knew? I found out. I effed around and found out. I was taking a sponsee with me to speak in Oklahoma because I was showing off. And I had thrown away a ticket because I didn't have a job. And I knew if I told my sponsor about the ticket, she'd say, you don't have a job, go sit in jail. And by then, I was doing a little talking in AA, like y'all were willing to pay for my gas money to hear my talk. I couldn't be wasting my time in jail. And so I went to jail, and I didn't show up in Oklahoma, and the sponsee fired me. I mean, like, it was really bad. And I know they call it anonymous, but I was not anonymous, because when I didn't show up in Oklahoma City, those people called everybody in the DFW Metroplex looking for me. Because apparently, at almost 10 years, I'd become reliable. Be careful, man. They'll start looking at you if you don't show up somewhere. So everybody was looking for me. It was humiliating. And I had to tell all of them the story. I called my sponsor and I told her what happened about the sponsee and the cop and going to jail and staying overnight and missing the speaking thing. And that woman was not a giggling, laughing sponsor. And yet she laughed so hard she almost wet her pants. And I said, 37 people have called looking for me. And she said, that is fantastic. She said, I want you to call them all back. Make sure they have time. Tell them the whole story. Tell them the whole, please don't leave out anything. Tell about how the sponsee said, officer, we are both sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you were going, tell her that part. And I called back 37 people. And I told them about going to jail on the way to Oklahoma City because I'd thrown away a ticket with a sponsee in the car. And no one was shocked but me. Every single one of those people went, yeah, that sounds about right. For my 10 years, I got to pick up a cake. Guess what was on the cake? Their favorite joke for about 3 months. Hey, Huddleston, what kind of bird don't fly? The correct answer, jailbird. For my 10 years, I got a jailbird cake, and man, I was hating y'all's guts. I was hating your guts, because you told the joke 25 times, and you laughed harder every single time, because it made me madder every single time you told it. Tell you what, if they're teasing you in AA, they care. They just might be saving your life. Because somewhere along the way, I figured out that the 10th step was more important than the 10 years. That living current and being honest and doing what needs to be done, the next right action, walking with some integrity, not being of service to your ego. I became more concerned about what happens when I'm trying to keep those secrets than I am of what you will think if I tell you the truth. And my life began to change from the inside out. And gradually things got better. What I'm like today is I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. I've talked to her this weekend. She knows she is my sponsor, and I am current with her. I take a daily inventory because I learned my lesson. And most days I write it down. I carry the message as best I know how, and my sobriety has changed. I have a deeper walk with God than I have ever had. And yet the things that you taught me in the beginning are still the things that sustain me today. I have done many, many things wrong. And my attention has been diverted by so many sparkly opportunities. But working with others is just like the flippers in pinball. When I start to wander off into the ditches, the phone rings. And I start telling her what to do, and suddenly I'm a player in Alcoholics Anonymous again. Because what I told her to do is the thing I need to be doing. Over and over and over again, God helps me when I help others. If you hear nothing else that I say tonight, God helps me when I help others. And I'm going to give you a couple of stories, and then I'm going to let you, you know, do whatever you got to do, play some bingo. So there was a sponsee that I was sponsored. I've always worked with folks, and I have always dreamed of having, you know, the little line of minions who will stand at the podium and go, "Oh, my life, the Jennifer HK." And someday I'm going to get one of those sponsees. I kind of tend towards the feral ones, and especially if you've got about 5 diagnoses, they go, "Oh, she's the mothership." I don't really have no diagnoses, but I look like I do, and I love working with others. I really do. It works when nothing else does. But there was a little gal that I got to know. I was in a meeting and I was talking about how I kind of like to steal stuff. It's a hobby of mine. And it got worse when I got sober because I stopped looking like somebody would steal. And I'm not saying I steal all the time. I'm just saying it's a pretty good barometer of my mental health. I mean, there are times, and the goofy stuff is, like, it's not Grand Theft Auto or nothing. It's like nail polish at the Walmart. I don't think there's anything I've ever stolen that I didn't have the money for in my purse. It's not about that. But for some reason, because I got no dang filter, I start sharing about this in a meeting. And here comes Twitchy after the meeting. Yeah. And she goes, "Oh, I'm stealing too." And I'm like, fantastic. And I've never bought any Burt's Bees, but I got 13 tubes of it in my car. And you're going to be shocked to learn that I start sponsoring Twitchy. And she'd call and she'd tell me the stuff she stole. It turned out she didn't really want to change. She just wanted somebody to know about it. Those secrets get really heavy. And I was trying to get better, but I would slip up every now and then. I was speaking out of town. It was one of those where I could drive to it. And we were driving back home. We stopped this place in Waco and she was wandering around the store and I went into the bathroom and in the back of the toilet, there was this big old bottle. A poopery. Y'all know about poopery? Man. The person who invented poopery ought to get a Nobel Peace Prize. I'm just saying. That's some magical stuff, but it's expensive. It's real spendy. And this thing said tester on it. They also had a sticker on there that said don't steal this or you'll have loose bowels or some poop-related joke, which I thought was really funny as I dropped it in my purse because it's not really stealing. If it's a tester, that's my loophole. So I dropped the poopery in my large tote bag and Twitchy's wandering around the store on her own and we walk out and neither one of us notices those metal things right there by the door, but we sure heard them. Beep, 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 beep. And I look at her and she looks at me and we start walking fast. And we get to the car and she and I both are real talkers. 45 minutes of complete silence. Followed by the serenity prayer. And during that quiet time, I discover that underneath that poop related joke was a sensor. And so I fold like a cheap lawn chair and I say, "Hey, do you know why that sensor went off in the store?" And she said, "Yep." And I said, "You do?" And she said, "Yep." And I reach in my bag and I pull out my bottle of poopery and she goes, "Shut up." And she pulls the car off the road, runs back to her backpack and pulls out, and y'all, I swear on the big book, this is true, a brand new bottle of poopery. She stole a bottle of pooper. And I know this is a jacked up story. And yet I cannot not tell it because it is just so elegant. The way in which God reached me. We stole the exact same thing. And we both laughed. And then I sat with it. And I realized that I was completely ineffective as a sponsor for her. Because I knew I had a character defect and I was living with it like it was okay. And that's not okay. And what I learned is anything that we know is objectionable and keep ignoring always escalates. It always escalates. I surrendered that day. She didn't. She didn't. Because her sponsor, in subtle ways and not so subtle ways, had said, oh, you've got 20-something years to wait on that. And that's not true. She told the truth, and she didn't get the consequences she should have gotten for those actions. But I learned a really important lesson. God helps me when I help others. Tweechy got real squirrely, and she had a secret, and it wasn't the kind of secret I was afraid she was going to drink over. It was the kind of secret I was afraid she was going to kill herself over. And the thing about it is, we all knew the secret, but she couldn't tell it. Maybe you know kind of what I'm talking about. And I got really afraid because I could not. She'd tippy-toe around it, and she'd do a little dance, but she wouldn't come all the way clean, and I couldn't let go. And my sponsor was pointing out to me that it was time to let her go. And I just couldn't do it. And so I tried to trick her into doing the steps because I'm not above it. She liked to journal. And so I said, okay, we're going to do some journaling exercises together. I'll write, you write, we'll share it. And I thought maybe I could get her through to the secret if we could just do these activities together. And so the first activity that I had her do was write 3 pages on God, here's why I don't trust you. And just because I said I would do it too, I did the writing. And the first page and a half of my writing was, of course I trust you. And I wrote out my resume just to show God how impressive my sobriety really is. And then the truth started spilling out. That's why I always recommend 3 pages. It's hard to lie for 3 whole pages. And what I saw was that I'd been managing my own money and it was awful. I was being really irresponsible and I was putting the weight on a whole lot of other people by not looking at that. And I was single-handedly trying to keep my mother alive during the pandemic, and it turns out that's not my department. And I had become sort of a terrorist in the process. And there were all these things that started spilling out on the paper, and she read me her paper, and I read her mine, and we kept going with the writing. And then I asked the power what the power wanted to be called, and as I wrote about it, what came out for me was love is God and God is love. And I started calling my power love. And man, it changed the quality of my prayers when I started praying to love. Because isn't that always the answer? How do I show up in a loving way? How do I answer in a loving way? How do I respond with love? How do I react with love? And I got this intimacy with God that I hadn't had in a really, really long time. She lost interest in the activity because it was never for her, but God helps me when I help others. And I'd already come up with 40 prompts for her, so I did all 40. And my life began to change, because that's how God reaches me. And my sobriety began to change, and my relationship with God began to change. My husband and I moved in with my mom, and we loved her very much. She and my husband are a lot alike, and man, that was exhausting. Neither one of them can ask for what they want very well, so I became the interpreter of sighs. And I always say, if you're going to get a roommate, get a 76-year-old. They're just handy. And we had a really good run, you know. We all got healthier as we lived together. But we were watching her change slowly. She had several different things going on. And one day she was coming down the stairs. She was 3 steps from the bottom, and one ankle came out from under and the other one didn't. And it was bad. And she didn't even know it was broken. She was asking me to help her stand up. And I was like, Mama, don't look down or we're both going to faint. And I knew as they were wheeling her out of the house that things were going to change. I didn't know she was going to die. But I knew that things were going to change, and about 7 months later, she was gone. And there were just a lot of things that just went really wrong really fast. And I don't know how you let go of somebody you can't be without. I wasn't doing very well with it, but let me tell you something. Alcoholics Anonymous showed up, and that didn't mean for me that people showed up in my living room. They didn't. That's on me. It's not them. But what would happen is that is that on the day that I sat in the driveway and just cried because I didn't know if I could do this one more day, I would go to the mailbox and I would find a card from somebody I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous from different parts of the country. And they would remind me that I'm a part of a worldwide fellowship and that we serve an awesome God and that we can do hard things. And that was just enough to get me to the next day. And eventually my sister and I walked my mama home, and it was really hard because she was really afraid. And I was kind of mad at God for that. But I can wrestle with my daddy, and he doesn't get mad at me. He's never going to hurt me. But I wrestled with him for a little while about that, because why did she have to be so afraid? Why couldn't she be at peace before she left? And eventually the answer came that maybe that wasn't about her, but so that me and my sister knew when it was time to let her go. So we let her go. And eventually it was time for me to travel again, and I didn't want to go because my husband's not one of us, but his drinking sometimes makes me nervous. And he doesn't have a network. And he doesn't have people that he calls or opens up to. And I don't go to the butterfly room. And so I got to come up with a solution single-handedly to keep my husband safe. I decide he needs a dog. Now, I don't like dogs. I know I lost almost everybody in this room, but I don't like dogs. They're weird and they're needy and they put their nose in your crotch. It's all awkward. And, but he needs a dog. And, so he comes home from work and I say, hey, want to go to the shelter? I want to look at a dog. He said, we're going to look at a dog. I said, we're going to look at a dog. We're just looking at a dog. Yes, we're just looking at a dog. I'll go look at a dog with you, but we're just looking at a dog. What did I say? I'm going to look at a dog. So on Saturday, we go to the shelter, and on the way to shelter, I say, hey, stop at Pets Plus. And he said, why? And I said, to get a leash. And he said, why? We're looking at a dog. I said, what if we like what we see? He said, good point. So we get a leash. And we go and we meet this dog. And actually, the first dog we tried to meet, there was no chemistry. I'm sure he's a perfectly fine dog, but he wasn't our dog. And then we met this little thug dog. He's a little pit docked ears. He looks real tough. He's a total weenie. And his name was Elroy. And after about 30 seconds, I said, is that our dog? And he said, yeah, that's our dog. And we took him home. I got that dog to help my husband so he wouldn't be alone. And I don't like dogs. I don't want a dog. It's just a lot. They ask a lot of you. But that next morning, he took his dad for a walk, and I came out of the bedroom, and he put his little paws on my chest, and his little tail was just whacking the hell out of me, and I felt like the Grinch, like my heart swelled three sizes, and I fell in love with this dog. I fell in love with this dog. And all of a sudden, you weirdos in AA who say things like, you know, that dog is God spelled backwards. All of a sudden, you start making sense. And the weirdest part was when I started falling in love with my dog, I started falling in love with everybody's dog. I just became this weirdo who in the grocery store would go, you got a dog? I want to see a picture. You want to see a picture of my dog? I mean, it's just weird. Turns out Elroy Jebediah Boo Boo Kelly is one of my greatest spiritual teachers. And one day I'm chasing him around the house to see what is in his mouth, because that's what you do when you have a dog. Drop it, drop it, drop it, drop it. So I'm chasing him and I'm yelling, drop it, and I'm laughing because he's so dang goofy. And I think, this is probably what God does. Like, he just watches me and goes, what is she doing? Look at her. What's in her mouth? It's cheese. She got cheese again. I give her all these beautiful vegetables. What she got in her mouth? Cheese. She just eating more cheese. But he's not mad. He's not disappointed. He knows me. He made me. He loves me exactly the way I am. He is the master, and I am his puppy. And I walked around for 3 weeks high on life going, I'm God's puppy. I'm a little weirdo, and he loves me no matter what. But the problem is, when you have a spiritual idea, it'll flip on you. And one day I'm telling people the puppy story, and I think, okay, I know what the master's job is. It's to keep you safe and provide what you need. to make sure that you don't do things that are dangerous and hurtful. It's to make sure that when you need to be cleaned, you're cleaned. And when you need medicine, we get you medicine. And when you need to be fed, you'll be fed. But what's the puppy dog's job? And I thought about my dog, and I'll just tell you about my dog. Every single morning, his daddy takes him for a walk. And every single morning, you would think that dog hit the freaking lottery. Are you kidding me? We're going for a walk today? I mean, it's this whole freaking production, up and down and twist around and beat the table with your tail. I mean, just this whole thing. He's enthusiastic every single day of his life. He sniffs the same stuff. He pees on the same bush. He does the same things over and over again. And he brings joy every single time. Because he was a long timer in a shelter. And what he has is a daily reprieve. One of the definitions for a daily reprieve is a stay of execution. And the reason Elroy was alive was somebody rescued him. And so he brings joy to his life because he was rescued. When your phone rings, do you go, are you kidding me? They're calling again? Yes! We've been pulled from the scrap heap. We have a solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree. Shouldn't we be a little enthusiastic? I'm not what I used to be, and I'm not what I will become. I live a beautiful life, and I am taken care of as long as I stick close to you and let God be the master. I've got a whole lot to wag my tail about, and I think you do too. I'm glad to be here, and it's a good day to be celebrating.